coming up on today's three-hour version of Boston Public Radio, the Global Post Charlie Sennett on prospects for resolution in Gaza and Ukraine. Then medical ethicist Art Kaplan on doctors for the one percenters. And could the future of caregiving be, are you ready, robots? Then Sue O'Connell on open mic on how many Americans actually are lesbian, gay, or bisexual.
Juliet Kayyem joins us on the crisis at the borders and the crisis of housing our own homeless. Then our concert roundtable, the very best new music and the best music around town in jazz, classical, and pop. All that's coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Marjorie Egan, you're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
You're not going to say this is a special three-hour edition of Boston Public Radio?
Oh, my goodness. It is a special three-hour edition. I was waiting for you to give the weather report, Jim, so I was momentarily flustered.
Okay. From weather to the serious, here are two brief leading headlines from around the world. Ukrainian Prime Minister says Putin is, quote, on the side of the devil. Another one, Curry arrives in Israel to broker Gaza ceasefire. Joining us online to put these and other headlines into context is GBH news analyst Charlie Sennett. Charlie, as you know, is the co-founder of Global Post, and he heads up the Ground Truth Project. Good morning, Charlie.
Morning, Jim. How are you?
Good.
Hey, Charlie. Thanks for
Marjorie.
Hi, Charlie. Thanks for joining us. So, as Jim just said, John Kerry is meeting with everybody, the United Nations, the Israelis, the Palestinians, today, and hoping to get somewhere in a ceasefire. What is the possibility that he can make progress?
Well, I think it's going to be really tough to make any progress. I think the Israelis have a lot of work they want to get done to destroy the network of tunnels that Hamas has built to Egypt, and I think that they probably won't let up until they feel they've accomplished that goal. Extraordinary challenge for Kerry in this shuttle diplomacy, you know, sort of going back and forth, crisscrossing the region, trying to build a case for a ceasefire. I think they'll ultimately get it, but I don't know that they're going to get it in the time frame they want to get it, and the death toll is getting dramatic. I mean, we're talking about 650 Palestinians killed now, 30 Israeli soldiers, three Israeli civilians, and climbing. And I think it's an enormous challenge for a lot of reasons for the Obama administration in particular right now.
You know, as someone who's just looking at this, following the news and reading the papers, you know, I get why they're trying to get rid of these tunnels because, of course, the Palestinians are using the tunnels to get arms and come into Israel, et cetera. I don't understand why there seems to be so much targeting of homes and hospitals. I know the excuse about the weapons there, but you look at this and you think this, you saw this family with 26 bodies, 19 of them children, in a single building. Why are they doing that?
Well, I think you're right on both counts, Marjorie. I mean, the Israelis do have deep concerns about the weapons that come through the tunnels, for sure. But the sense that this is sort of the most tribal, and what I would even say is barbaric, sort of retaliatory bombing, this sort of collective punishment, is something that the UN Human Rights High Commissioner has very explicitly stated is a violation of international law. That's been clearly stated. We're hearing deep concerns coming out of the White House from President Obama and from Secretary of State Kerry about what is happening in Gaza. This feels an awful lot like collective punishment. We remember this starts with the three Israeli teenagers who were killed, and it begins a cycle that is the most depressing thing of all to watch in the Middle East. For those of us who've watched it a really long time, to see this just, I can't think of any word other than tribal, retaliatory bombing is really disturbing. And I think Israel owes it to the U.S., it owes it to the world, and it just owes it to its own history not to allow itself to go where it appears to be going right now in Gaza.
Speaking of the U.S. and Israeli relations, Charlie Sennett, does the hot mic comment off air of Secretary of State Kerry when he essentially sounds like to an aide that he's criticizing sarcastically Israel's strikes.
Yeah, the so-called pinpoint strikes. Which
right. Does that have does that make it even harder for him to bring Netanyahu and the Israelis to the table, or is that just seen as an aside and let's just move on?
I don't think so. I mean, there's no really, there's not a lot of good faith between President Obama and Secretary of State Kerry and Netanyahu, Bibi Netanyahu, Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu, because for a long time, since the talks really broke down in April, there has been a lot of bad blood between Washington and the Israeli government. And I think that quip doesn't really damage that relationship any further in any meaningful way. And I actually think to some extent it's not bad in the region for this eye for America's cynicism about even the way its great ally and great friend Israel is acting. We need to be even-handed, and we do not have a reputation for that. I mean, one of the critical characters here in this equation is General el-Sisi, now President el-Sisi of Egypt. And remember, he is the one who the U.S. is hoping can help with bringing some kind of deal in which Hamas and Israel create a ceasefire. But Hamas has no trust for el-Sisi. El-Sisi is the one who took the Muslim Brotherhood, right, who Hamas has this deep affinity with. Really, they grow out of the same political ideology. And, you know, he's the one who, of course, you know, did a military coup, toppled the democratically elected government that was led by the head of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. And so there's a great spirit of distrust of el-Sisi and of the U.S. by Hamas. I don't think the U.S. is going to be able to position itself as an even-handed broker in this equation and gain the trust it's going to need to get anything meaningful happening. A ceasefire, a very clearly focused attempt at a ceasefire is possible, and it needs to be done. And Kerry has the kind of dogged diplomacy that and attention to detail that's required to get it done. I think he will get it done. I just don't think it's going to happen as quickly as they want it to, because the Israelis have more work they want to do.
One last thing from me before we switch to the other part of the world that's exploding, Ukraine. You've been to Gaza, have you not, Charlie Sennett?
I have, many, many times. I've been in the tunnels, in fact.
Really? Describe both the tunnels and describe the living situation, if you can, for us in Gaza, Charlie.
You know, I used to, when I was Middle East bureau chief for the Boston Globe, it was very common to have the foreign editors or sometimes even the editor-in-chief come and visit. And one thing I always had them do was come with me to Gaza and go through the checkpoint, because it is an experience in which those of us who lived there as journalists, we could go to what's called the VIP entrance and walk right through, unhassled, be into Gaza, no problem. This was true at least years back. It's harder now. But what I would do is I would take them through the way that Palestinian laborers have to come into Gaza, through the barbed wire with this sort of, you know, bomb-sniffing dogs, Israeli soldiers barking orders, the feeling of complete domination, the sense of a people living under occupation. And it's really shocking for Americans to see it. It is something that when you physically hear the way these young Israeli soldiers are yelling at the Palestinians, ordering them around at gunpoint, making them stand in the sun, searching everything they have, ripping open the different produce that they might be having to try to bring in. And this was in the good days, right? This was when it felt like the peace process might work. Now it's even worse. There's very little flow between the two sides of the border there. But once you do enter into Gaza, you're in a ramshackle world that is full of contrast. Sort of tall, modern skyscrapers built by all of the European and American funding that's been poured into Gaza, and vast refugee camps that are the remnant and the sort of the leftover physical representation of the wars, 48 and 67, which pushed millions of Palestinian refugees into this tiny strip of land called Gaza. And when you see those are, you know, just really, you can't believe the poverty, open sewers, you know, like cinder block construction, really deep sense of despair and hopelessness for decades and generation after generation. And it's hard not to see that a group as militant and I would say even murderous and dark as Hamas. I mean, this is a death cult, Hamas, right? I mean, this is just hard to imagine how far they've strayed from any sense of anything that we could deal with as another side politically, how that could be attractive to a community that's lived under occupation, that sees no hope, that sees that the peace process is going nowhere. We can't expect them to just keep on going like this and not see them veer into extremism. I mean, it's a terrible equation. I wish I knew what to do here. I think there has to be some starting points, ceasefire clearly being one of them. But another one is to wake up the world to the fact that we know where this has to go. You know, there are four former heads of the Shin Bet, which is the Israeli intelligence agency, that say Israel should give back Gaza and the West Bank. That's four of the top heads of security of Israel who are still living, who are retired, agree. Now, lots of smart people in Israel think that. Close to half the population believes that. Why is it that we don't get to that endpoint of a return of the West Bank and Gaza is a question that I think we all in the United States, as an ally of Israel, as a deep supporter, close friend of Israel, we need to push harder on that question. And we need to be a little bit more challenging to our ally, and because it's going to have a lot to do with trying to establish stability back in a region that is right now in deep turmoil.
Well, you've laid out John Kerry's task, Charlie Sennett.
We're talking, yeah. Charlie Sennett is...
Not a small one.
Is the co-founder of a Global Post. Charlie, let's move on to Ukraine. Europe is in a difficult position vis-a-vis Vladimir Putin, of course, because they're very dependent upon him for their winter warmth. We need them to help us put the screws, can I say that on the radio, to Putin, I guess. What's the likelihood of that happening?
Well, look, this situation with Russia is incredible. I mean, there's really no question that the U.S. is building a solid case that the pro-Russian rebels are responsible for this attack, right? But if you look at the landscape of the media in particular, I think The Guardian had an excellent piece today looking at the Russian media. Did you see this piece?
No.
How the Russian media is promoting all these conspiracy theories that the bodies were fake bodies.
Oh.
This didn't really happen.
Also the Ukraine itself was firing at the plane because they thought Vladimir Putin was on the plane.
And we did it.
Exactly.
Weren't we in there too?
That's right.
They missed him and hit that.
Yeah, the Americans did it.
Right. So the absurdity of Russia reveals something to me, which is this is an observation that you can see in your own life, maybe, or you can see globally in a context, and that is the least powerful are often the most conspiratorial. And I think some of what we're seeing right now with this dramatic incident and taking down that airliner and Russia's responsibility for it one way or another, whether they trained the pro-Russian rebels or whether they actually had a hand in being part of that, I think what might happen is it was a heat-seeking missile, right, which locked on.
Yeah.
Some poorly trained rebels got a hold of a SAM-7 missile and did that. But either way, Russians are responsible. If they supplied that, if they so-called trained this organization, or if they were there when it happened, they're clearly trying to cover something up. But the reaction in Russia reveals a weak former empire trying to restore some semblance of control over the region it once dominated and some sense of power. And this restoration of power, if you look back at history, it's a perilous time. Like this is why, you know, we've talked a lot about comparing World War I and the moment that started World War I and today, and fading and rising empires in a world in which there are multipolar sources of power, none of which seem to be balancing each other out very well, but living in this sort of period of chaos and turmoil. And I think it connects the Middle East and the Ukrainian incident, that we live in a time of great uncertainty. We need Russia to solve our negotiations with Iran on its nuclear program. We need Iran and Russia to try to end the war in Syria. So these parts are all interlocking. And, you know, I'm here on vacation. I'm on Martha's Vineyard.
Oh, good for you.
Gather. Big news here is Blues are running very big.
Okay,
right,
Charlie,
off
fine, yeah.
So,
and,
you know,
and my, the president's on his way, yeah.
I don't know if the president can go now because he's going to take too much grief if he tries to take vacation.
But seriously, there was some rush. There were some really top oil industry analysts and traders here who I had drinks with, and we're talking in depth about the global oil markets. Very interesting observation that what seems to make no sense to us, why is Putin acting this way? What could possibly be behind his rationale? And these very knowledgeable and sometimes cynical oil executives and analysts were saying it's really obvious. He needs to keep oil at $110 a barrel. That's how he maximizes profit for him, because he personally is controlling the national oil operations in Russia. And therefore, to keep it at 110, the uncertainty in the Ukraine, establishing his lockdown on Crimea, fostering uncertainty so that he could potentially take more land, more control, more access to the ports that he'll need, as well as destabilizing Iran and keeping Syria in a destabilized situation, all help him force up the price of oil in the global markets, particularly for Russian crude. And they really think that there is a method to the madness right now, and that it would tie back to the oil market. So it's just like one of those interesting conversations you hear here, where there's a lot going on with people from different worlds and different expertise that arrive on this island. And
you know, I'm just like you, Charlie. When I go to the Cape and go to Provincetown soon, the first thing I'm going to do is seek out people to talk about the global oil market. Hey, you know, Charlie, I want to one last thing on this.
I get some fishing in, too, Jim.
Yeah, I'm sure you
do.
Wrong,
okay?
You know,
I want to know where you were having the cocktails, Charlie. That's what I want to know.
You know, if people want to focus on this whole economic issue, if you want to see a confederacy of dunces, if you Google the interview that Chris Cuomo from CNN attempted to do with the guy who runs Russia Today this morning on CNN, and the reason it's significant is Cuomo was in the Netherlands, and Netherlands has been amongst the most reluctant to impose sanctions on Russia, and obviously they have the most victims from this flight. One last thing about this, though, if I can, Charlie, is I was saying to Marjorie, what's most troubling to me is all the diplomats who I've heard, both in Europe, John Kerry, etc., say Putin has got to wise up and back off its support for the separatists in eastern Ukraine. That's all I hear. That's the mantra. And what makes me nervous is that all there is, in the words of Peggy Lee, meaning if Putin ultimately got that message, does that mean that we forget, the international community forgets holding anybody accountable for practically 300 murders? I mean, do you understand what I'm saying? And we only have a minute left, if you can.
Well, look, it's a great question. And clearly we've forgotten about many different regimes that commit murder that we seem to be willing to do business with if it's good for us. But one thing in this economic equation to keep an eye on is the EU sanctions. Visa bans, asset freezes. This is showing and revealing itself in the Russian markets in a way that sanctions can be effective. And, you know, that's already bringing down the Russian stock market. It's having some impact. Unfortunately, it's that kind of economic responsibility. We can bring people to hold people responsible through economic sanctions more than we can through international forum, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Charlie, it's great to talk to you. Enjoy those blues and those conversations about global oil.
Charlie, thank you very much for being with us, and enjoy the rest of your vacation. Charlie Sennett is the co-founder of Global Post and heads up the Ground Truth Project. He's also a news analyst for us here at WGBH. Up next, there is demand for healthcare workers. Are robots going to fill the void? Do they understand the full implication of I've fallen and I can't get up? Bioethicist Art Kaplan joins us for that conversation next at WGBHnews.org, Boston Public Radio.
This week on Innovation Hub, you know those kids buried in their phones? They're paying more attention than you think.
When people who are currently, you know, teenagers grow up, I think they're going to expect that their government better reflects what they want and what they believe in.
Politics for a New Generation. I'm Kara Miller. That's on Innovation Hub. Thursday night at 9 here on 89.7 WGBH.
WGBH Radio exists thanks to you and the Commonwealth Shakespeare Company, the theater in residence at Babson College, presenting Twelfth Night, Shakespeare's classic comedy of Love in Disguise, playing free on the Boston Common now through August 10th. More at comshakes.org. And Death in Paradise, London's bumbling detective Inspector Humphrey Goodman is assigned to solve crime on a sunny Caribbean island. Season 3 of Death in Paradise continues tonight at 9 on WGBX 44.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Again, a special three-hour edition today of Boston Public Radio. You know, one of the many crises facing our healthcare system is we don't have enough caregivers to tend our aging population. Adult children often have to step in to take care of their parents, which obviously can cause serious familial stress. Then there's the occasional case of caregivers abusing the people who are dependent on them. So could the answer to this healthcare dilemma come in the form of a robot? Joining us in line for his take on this and other medical ethical issues is bioethicist Art Kaplan. Art is head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center, and he also co-edited the book Contemporary Debates in Bioethics. Hello there, Art Kaplan.
Hello, hello.
Hi, Art Kaplan. Thanks for being with us as always. You know, before we get to the robots and your great piece about physician shortage, I wanted to ask you really quickly. There were two court decisions yesterday, Art, that caused people to be very nervous about the future of Obamacare, and we don't know how this is going to end. But one of the questions is, of course, subsidizing people's health care and whether this is going to stand. So what does this do to people that are out there right now getting their health care subsidized? This has to turn them into nervous wrecks.
It does. And I think one of the court decisions said, we're really sorry to have to do this, but, we're not sure this subsidy is going to turn out to be legal. But they understood that they were really leaving people in a kind of untenable limbo. And really, the whole point of this health reform effort has been to subsidize people who can't afford insurance. And you can argue about whether that's a sufficient reform of the healthcare system or it's just a way to enrich the insurance companies. But from the point of view of an individual or a family, you want to know, am I going to get some help in getting insurance? And that was the whole point. And to me, I don't know the legal ins and outs, but ethically, we do need to subsidize people. If you give them more preventive care, if you give them more primary care, it's cheaper. It will save us money. It's not a handout. You want them out of the emergency room where it's expensive and into a primary care or nurse practitioner's office. Boy, does that make sense. And if this fails on technical legal grounds, it's really just an utter ethical travesty.
You know, let's spend just one more minute on this, though. I'm thinking if somebody works somewhere and they're worried, they hear rumors that their job may be at risk. We all know what that does to us psychologically. It puts you just in total angst 24/7.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm trying to equate the same thing. Whether people are for or against Obamacare is irrelevant for this discussion. They hear the first court decision yesterday, and they believe, because they don't know about stays, they don't know about the second court, appellate court coming out. They say, oh my God, my $4,400 federal subsidy is going to disappear in an hour or whatever it is, or may disappear, that sort of thing. What impact? Do people stop you going to doctors? I don't mean this facetiously. Are they in psychological angst? I mean, what impact does that potential, that threat and loss have on them?
Understood. And the answer is they stop going to doctors until they really get too sick to be able to stand it. When they go at that point, obviously the chances of getting it fixed go down, and it's more expensive to repair whatever the problem was. So if you have diabetes, you don't go in until you're really almost in a coma. If you have a heart problem, you stop buying your medicines. You don't do anything until somebody finds you on the floor. We know what the consequences are. People delay. People push off or don't show up or don't do anything, and they just get sicker. It's not a hypothetical. It's reality. That's how people manage their lives. And somebody might say to me, yeah, but that doesn't stop them from, buying a lottery ticket. I admit it. They do other things. But healthcare, if you don't have that subsidy, they tend to think, well, I'm going to put that off and I'll do the other things I have to do to keep my life going.
Well, one perverse benefit of that behavior may be it'll alleviate the primary doctor shortage crisis in America. Art, you've written this great essay. I've read a million essays, so has Marjorie, about the primary doctor shortage, and I'm sick of them. Yours is a little different. You actually embrace a possible solution for the crisis, at least an interim solution. What is it?
So we've got, just to lay this our next miserable problem out, this one is we don't have enough primary care doctors. So even if you extend those health subsidies and extend coverage to more people, it's not clear that there are primary care doctors, family doctors, general internists to see them. So everybody knows this problem, because think about it. If you wanted to see your primary care doctor and get an appointment, it's going to be a month or 2 months. People know that they have a hard time finding one in a lot of the country. If you're in a rural area in New England, there may not be one there. So what are we going to do about it? Well, we opened up some medical schools, new ones, to try and encourage more primary care docs. We'll see. But even if more people from those new medical schools wind up going, and I'm talking about places like Quinnipiac in Connecticut, it's going to take 10 years before we see them in the labor pool. I mean, it takes a long time to become a doctor. So listening to all this complaining and moaning, I said, well, you know, what could be done? And there is an idea that's floated up. What about people who are in medical school? They pass their exams, but for some reason, they don't get accepted into a residency program. And that's the key step to practice. Usually you do it for a year, but really 3 years. So if you want to be a surgeon, you, after medical school, apprentice for 3 years. Same thing if you want to be a cardiologist. But even primary care people usually spend a year or two working for a experienced doctor. What if we said, hey, there's not enough residencies. You can't match. Foreign medical school graduates have this problem. What if we made them into assistant physicians or physician juniors or, you know, mini physicians or something, and said you can practice, but you can only have a limited practice and you got to do it under the supervision of another doctor for a while? I think they could deliver good primary care. State of Missouri is going to try it. State of Michigan is thinking about it. Other states are looking at it. I think it's the way to go. And I know people are going to say, whoa, two class medical care, you know, they're not as good as the fully trained docs. But if I live in rural Western Massachusetts or up in, you know, the Northeast Kingdom or someplace in Vermont, I'd rather have something than nothing.
You know, Art, it sounds like a fantastic idea to me. But I was also thinking as I was reading your piece, well, don't we already have physician's assistants, and why can't they fill the breach here?
Oh, we do, and there are programs that let them do what I'm talking about. After a two-year training program, you get assigned to a doc. You work under that doc. The problem is you literally have to be close by. You're kind of assisting that physician. So
okay.
If there's no doctor in rural wherever or inner city whatever,
okay,
then you're not there. So we should have more of them, too. I'm all for more physician assistants. But I like the idea of saying, you know what, let's take advantage of this trained population of folks, again, many coming from overseas, which a lot of people are going to sort of turn their nose up. But for primary care, I think they've got enough training, as long as we keep an eye on them, to help somebody manage their asthma or make sure that you're losing weight or try to help you measure your sugar levels if you're a diabetic. There's a bunch of things that could be done, really make a health impact, get some primary care out there. So some docs are thinking, well, you know, I went to medical school. I don't need these halfway doctors competing with me. But let's face it, we've tried forever to try and get doctors to move to rural areas and practice in the inner city. They don't do it. So here's a group that might do it.
You know, two quick thoughts about this. One real positive thing is, I think, you know, you say, well, what's the reaction of the doctors groups? In Missouri, the State Medical Association, which represents the docs in the state, is actually in support of this, which I think is...
And I got to interrupt and say, yeah, I about fell out of my chair,
yeah,
when I saw that. No, I was like, really?
But the flip,
good for them.
The flip side about the two-class system, you mean, I was a legal services lawyer in the South Bronx, and there was not a day that passed when a potential client who was sitting in the lobby would say, I don't want a legal services. I want a real lawyer. So, I mean, there is that kind of thing. In any case, Art, let's continue the misery index before we get to potentially something positive. We talk a lot about income inequality in the show. Everybody talks about income inequality these days. You talk about the primary care shortage. It has potential to be even further exacerbated and need more solutions because of the fact that the 1%ers or the 3%ers or the 5%ers have the ability to essentially get to the front of the line. No?
Oh, yeah.
And how so?
Here's how so. I own a plane. I need an organ transplant. most human beings are going to have to register in a program in the area where they live, in Boston, in New York. If I'm a rich person, let's make one up. Let's say I owned a certain large computer company and I needed a liver transplant. I might fly around the country and register myself at 10 different places all around the country. Think of it as putting more chips on the roulette wheel, mm-hmm. and an organ might come up for me and I can get it because I can fly back. If you're really super rich, you can go to the head of line in a bunch of ways. I'll just say at a certain institution that I don't want to name, but I happen to work, if you showed up with a lot of dough, I'll bet we could grease the skids for you and somehow get you in faster if we thought, oh, that's a potential donor. I know it gets done for wealthy foreigners, for sure. You know, they're flying into Logan and heading off to the Boston hospitals and getting some pretty boutique treatment. And you can get a leg up in other ways. You know the specialist. You know who to call. You're connected. You can get on the phone and find somebody. Was it always that way? Probably. Is it always going to be that way? Probably.
Isn't there an ethical issue? I mean, we've read in our papers locally about these concierge doctors, and if you pay cash, you don't have to wait for insurance. You get special access. Isn't there an ethical issue for medical professionals here?
Well, I think it's unfair, unjust, completely indefensible, and it's never going away. So,
yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, if you know you've got some loaded person that can help you out, it is never going to go away. I mean, if you're the kind of person that can donate whole wings of a hospital, you know, you think locally the big wigs are able to do that, don't get special treatment, absolutely.
But just for one second here, how can it not be an ethical issue that there's a line of 10 people, not literally, but maybe literally or figuratively waiting, and because one person is not going to make the doctor submit an insurance claim, they're going to pay up front cash, and they get to the front. How can that not be an ethical issue for a provider of medical care?
Because in a capitalist market economy, money talks. Look, you're in a country where you check in at the air to go on an airplane flight, and guess what? The first class people get their own line.
Yeah.
They're ahead of you.
Yeah.
And it's a public thing. It's
I don't like that
day.
Either,
what,
Art, let me tell
me?
You.
Okay.
But there they go. You see them marching in. So I'm going to say this. I'm more worried about who's outside the system. I know we want to get our outrage going about the 1%. I'm worried about the 10 to 15% who can't get in. So let's say the real justice question is not so much who's at the ceiling, but who's in the basement. That's what worries me.
We're talking to our medical ethicist, Art Kaplan, and now we've come to my favorite story of the day.
Me too.
I've seen the future. I think I'm going to be spending it with a robot. The idea that robots...
I knew you'd like this story. I knew you'd like it.
Well, you know, part of me is horrified, and part of me thinks, it, especially if you have dementia, what the heck? It could be great. So tell us about robots as caregivers, Art Kaplan, please.
Well, being a caregiver to a person, let's say with Alzheimer's, is incredibly demanding on the caregiver.
Yeah.
And you want to be loving, and you want to be kind, and you feel like a good family member. And you know this, it's 24/7, and there's plenty of caring to do and toileting, and you're not getting positive feedback because they don't recognize you or they don't remember you all the time, and they're fading away, and it's psychologically awful. Robot doesn't have any of those issues, and the robots that are coming can be expressive, can be emotional, can be supportive. Of course, it's all phony, and it's not real in the conscious sense. But to the person receiving the care, particularly with that kind of a condition, I don't think it matters a lot. We know they get great benefit from pets. You know, having animals around has been shown to be very helpful to lots of people. I think robots, I know you don't want to hear this, they are inevitable. They're just cheaper. They're less burdensome on the as caregivers. They're going to be able to do a very sophisticated set of jobs. Heck, they may be able to lift up people and move them around in ways that your average family member couldn't do. They're not strong enough.
But I don't think we should limit this conversation. Maybe this is the transitional phase.
What do you mean, robot radio?
No, I should doing, well, that's coming
that's
too.
That's coming too.
You know, about mechanical problems or older people with dementia, Alzheimer's. I mean, we all saw the movie with Joaquin Phoenix falling in love with an operating system, Scarlett Johansson. By the way, almost everybody in the audience fell in love with the operating system.
Me, I'm there, yeah.
The notion that they can fill a larger role, because it's sort of like what you said before, if the choice is between X, which is imperfect, or Y, which is no service. I'll choose X, meaning those people that didn't get into residency programs. Same situation here for normal old people who are really lonely or who embarrassed to ask a human to help them with a particular thing. It makes me feel weird. I can see people building relationships with machines, can't you?
Well, by the way, isn't that the relationship you have to your computer and your television set?
Yep.
They are things that entertain you. I know people who talk to the television set, but, you know, you don't have to go that far. But it's a mechanical device that entertains and provides you with a stream of feedback, if you want to put it that way. And the more interactive that machine becomes, we can get used to robots, mechanical assistants, as you say, even for mentally with it folks. I think robots are coming in the other direction. They're going to do more cleaning and housekeeping and stuff like that around the house. We're going to see them there too. They're going to walk the dog. Some people have them mowing the lawn now, right? You started to see that. So they're going to be part of our lives, and it doesn't bother me or frighten me that they're going to take on roles in caregiving as well. Part of me says good. Some of that work is just too overwhelming and too physically demanding and too emotionally draining. This will be better. I'm not saying you have to choose it, but I think it's something that people are going to wind up using a lot.
Well, you also think about people who try very hard to keep their elderly relatives at home.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
One of the problems a lot of elderly people have is they can't sleep. These robots don't need to sleep. I mean, they can be keeping you company in the middle of the night.
They can read to you.
Take a lot of the burden off the mother.
They can play chess with you. They can do all kinds.
Exactly.
You know, they can do many, many things.
Yeah.
And you know, one of the things I hear from caregivers, and I'm sure people are out there thinking, I still want to do it myself. But, you know, you want a break. You need some time off. You want to go on a vacation.
Yes.
Then what? So here comes the robot. Now you can go away for a few days, leave that person in the care of the robot and perhaps a supervisor who comes in just to check. But, you know, you get the relief a little bit from the role. And I'm not saying, I'm not trying to put down the role of family caregiver. It's noble. It's great. It's virtuous. But it's demanding and tough. It's very, very hard. I talked to a lot of folks with a kid who's sick, a lot of folks caring for an elderly family member, and boy, they are
it's
just
hard.
Drained. And I have to say, usually women, not men.
That's right.
It's great that the only uplifting part of our conversation today with Art Kaplan was about robots, not humans.
I am a little concerned about what happens when the thing breaks or needs to go in for maintenance or something like that.
Call another robot.
I guess you would. It's not
the
same.
The robot repair person appears.
Okay. Art Kaplan,
Art, it's great to talk to you.
Thank you for being with us.
Hey, my pleasure.
Art Kaplan is the head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. He also co-edited the book Contemporary Debates in Bioethics. Up next, a new report out of the CDC finds that less than 3% of the United States population identifies themselves as gay. We'll be joined by a member of this less than 3%. Sue O'Connell is here for Open Mic. Stay tuned to WGBHnews.org for that conversation.
More than half of recent graduates are unemployed or underemployed.
On Campus is WGBH's higher ed desk.
With the cost of college soaring, more and more students are demanding a return on investment.
When a student comes here, they've got a whole list of courses they're supposed to take. They know what they need to do to get a degree. They don't know what they need to do to get a job.
Listen for reports from Kirk Carapeza on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Funding for our programs comes from you and iFest, September 26th to 28th, bringing Ireland to the Seaport World Trade Center, Boston. This three-day festival will showcase contemporary Irish culture, entertainment, and culinary innovation. Tickets at ifestboston.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan, our special three-hour edition today. Here with us in Studio 3 for Open Mic is Sue O'Connell. Sue, as you know, is the co-publisher of Bay Windows and the South End News. Hello there, Sue O'Connell.
Hey, Jim. Hi, Marjorie.
Hello, Sue O'Connell.
Happy summer.
Happy summer. So nice to see you
again. So exciting. Yes, good to be here.
So I'm going to start with this new survey from the Centers for Disease Control. The number I always heard, and maybe I was mistaken all these years, is that about 10% of people are gay or lesbian or some some permutation.
Something.
Yes.
Some permutation.
That's right. And or bisexual or whatever. This survey says, and this is recently done, that 1.6% of people surveyed identify themselves, and this is 34,000 adults, by the way, identify themselves as gay or lesbian, and it was even lower, 0.7%. as bisexual. Do you buy these numbers?
No, there's only five people, actually, who are LGBT, and you know them all. So, no, it's the surveys. It's you're trying to quantify something that in some ways is not quantifiable.
Uh-huh.
You know, that you're asking people if they are gay or lesbian or bisexual, and you're not kind of rating them on the Kinsey scale, which still exists as a way to measure folks.
What do you mean by that? I don't get what's not quantifiable.
Well, you're asking a certain small group of people and expecting that within this population, which is true for most surveys, but in this population, you're actually going to be able to get something you can extrapolate out that far. And the way the survey was done just doesn't work that way.
Yeah, but somebody who looks very much like you used to do a radio show. I think it was called 1 in 10.
Yeah, that was me. Yeah, that was the name of my show. I forgot.
Yes. So, how do you know that you're closer to accurate than the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, which released this survey? Why do you think, what's the evidence that you know what you're talking about as opposed to them?
Well, the evidence is mostly in the type of survey that you do. You know, gays and lesbians, like a lot of minorities, don't like to tell the government certain things because it gets them nervous that they're actually self-disclosing themselves as gay or lesbian. Yeah. Many folks are still in the closet, so, you know, you immediately downgrade the survey results because people don't want to come out to anybody, basically. And then you have the sort of wide net that goes into identifying what I'll say is homosexual behavior just for the sake of the scientific discussion. You have men who have sex with men who don't identify as gay. They're M2M is what they call themselves.
What does that mean?
That means they have sex with men, but they still identify themselves as straight and don't necessarily identify with the mainstream gay community. You have women who may be in heterosexual relationships, but from time to time have homosexual relationships, which women are more want to do than men are because their sexual orientation is more fluid and less fixed than men's are. And they may not identify themselves as lesbian. So it's just a difficult thing to quantify.
So Sue O'Connell from Bay Windows, does it matter if it's 2% people are gay, 7% people are gay, 10%? If it does,
yeah,
why?
I mean, I think it does in terms of being a minority who can be counted. And if you look at the numbers of same-sex marriages, which has been a better indicator, if you look at Massachusetts, where we've had 10 years, the numbers are coming out that it's, if you compare them to their straight counterparts, it's coming up at about 10%. And women are more likely to marry than men, which is not surprising. And we've always had this feeling that in the sort of, you know, gay ink community, there are more gay men than there are lesbians. And that sort of comes out, it bears out, there's probably 60% more gay men than there are lesbians.
Really?
And again, there's no survey. You just, everywhere you go, you just sort of see this population represent itself.
I would have thought there were more lesbians than gay men.
You keep hoping, Marjorie.
Now, may I answer your question? Is a straight person answer
yes,
your question?
Jim.
A straight man who has impersonated a lesbian on
that's
AOL.
Exactly right.
Yes.
I have, but in a former life. I actually think it matters a lot.
Yeah.
Because if you, since the courts are much more rapidly than I've been discussing this with you for more than a decade, I am stunned by the rapidity in which red state federal court judges are saying, I'm sorry, it violates our state constitution to limit marriage between a man and a woman. I mean, it's almost every day you wake up and there's another one. It seems to me that when you read all the inside books about courts and you realize despite the justices saying politics have nothing to do with everything, politics have everything to do with everything. And if it turns out that the gay, lesbian, bisexual community can be marginalized by justices who are not yet on the train, it's a lot easier to rule against gays, lesbians on those issues. If it turns out that data shows that it is 10% of the population or 12% or whatever, it's a much harder Am I not right about that?
You are right. Of course you're right, Jim. But the counter of that is that I'm always surprised at how people think we're everywhere because we are everywhere. We seem to run everything. We're on TV. We're on the radio. We're in the news all the time. And when you sit down with somebody, especially when you talk about transgender rights and transgender issues, and you say, we are talking about a tiny, 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 tiny population, and there's no great panic that you need to have about this. So I think it works
both ways. You know, speaking of transgender, the president saying, as he's been wont to do lately, if Congress won't do it, I will. Well, he finally did it. We talked about it in the context of this executive order. He was about to sign, which would prohibited lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender federal contractors from discriminating based on that identification. We talked about in the context of Gordon College signing on to one of Massachusetts College signing on as one of the 15 signers, saying we want a, they don't call it this, a Hobby Lobby kind of exemption. How big a deal is this executive order for federal contractors and federal employees?
Well, it's huge because the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, which I think children have now grown up and gotten jobs waiting for this Employment Non-Discrimination Act to pass as a federal mandate. Yeah. You know, I've been working on it since 1992, which would guarantee that you can't be fired simply because someone thinks you're gay or thinks you're straight. I mean, it works always. That has not passed yet. It is still having a very difficult time going forward. There was a religious exemption in it now, so many of the gay activists and groups have pulled out of wanting the Employment Non-Discrimination Act to pass. So now what, as you said, the president has done is said, well, I'm going to offer the protections.
And with no exemptions.
With no religious exemption, which is a huge deal. And the more important part of this is that the research that we have done back to research back in the 90s showed that Americans, for the most part, if you go in and work your day, you know, your work day, 40-hour week, and you punch out, they don't care what you are. And this was expected to be the first right that would be passed. You know, we'd get protections on the job, you'd get to know us, and then we'd get everything else. So it's really shocking that this still hasn't happened, but that the president has taken this very bold step forward in guaranteeing these rights.
Sue O'Connell from Bay Window, she wrote a great piece about the whole crisis of not just the borders, but kids coming, kids that are coming over the border from Central America coming into Massachusetts. The Globe has a poll today that says 50% of those polled are okay with the kids coming here to Massachusetts, 43% opposed. You talked in your piece, I thought it was interesting, about conservatives being more fearful, and it is mostly conservatives that are opposing these kids coming here.
Yeah, I mean, my point is if we said 50,000 puppies were coming out over the border, everybody would be lining up to foster these puppies, right? No one would be worried about their shots or whether they had TB or if they were pit bulls. I mean, you can't even go
I'd
on Facebook. You'd be worried
bulls,
about the pit bulls. But you can't even go on Facebook without seeing puppies who are starving that need homes, you know, and suddenly we don't seem to care about these kids. And I know that you've talked about it on the show, these research studies that come out, we seem to be doing the research hour, that show that conservatives are more fearful. Their brains tend to be the wary ones, the ones who are more nervous, and they seem to be the ones that are most afraid of these kids coming into America. No one has said that these puppies and kittens, because that's what I'm going to call them from now on, because people will care more, these puppies and kittens have to stay here. We're simply talking about some foster homes for them, for the most part.
But you know, I see this more less conservative and liberal as a class issue, because I think that, you know, those people, those of us who are lucky enough to live in the Brooklines or the Wellesleys or the Westons or something, we're not going to have to worry about any of these children coming into our schools, because they're probably not going to come to these towns. And the parents of kids in the poor towns are already in a mess with their kids and lack of good services in the schools, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They're the ones, I think, a lot of these parents that are worried about these kids
but this
coming
is,
in.
But this is a worry that every American has, regardless of these kids coming in. You go to any school district, and they are even the most suburban affluent ones. I was just vacationing on an affluent island where I was talking to someone who has the off-season workers who are staying all season now, and their kids don't speak English. Their kids are having a hard time reading, like we've been reading about kids who have English as a second language. Yeah. Every school district has to deal with this. So it's sort of a red herring argument. I mean, it's the kids are probably not going to stay here. You know, we're arguing like they've already moved into Bourne and have started attending the school district. They're going to get federal funds to pay for the children to be here, and they'll figure it out. I mean, it's just so anti-American
this. Potentially makes it an even redder herring. The governor's going to be with us tomorrow, and I'm guessing this will be the first topic we address with him. His contention is yours, which I think is really where the breakdown is, and maybe this is a conservative liberal issue, maybe it isn't, is the whole issue of who's going to pay for this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And because there are a limited number of dollars, the governor and his people continue to say that with the exception of some kids who be united with families and that sort of thing, who will end up in the public school system, the vast majority, everything in their lives when they come here for a handful of months is going to be in a federal situation on these federal bases funded by the federal government, whatever. You raised the question about a week ago when we started talking about this, Marjorie. How about schools for them? I forget who you asked that question. Well, at least from my reading in the last 24 hours, the intention, and we'll ask the governor this, is that whatever education they get, they will get in the facility where they would be placed, assuming this up to 1,000 gets here. But the part, and Marjorie helped me with this, and a teacher from Brockton who basically told me I was clueless the other day who called in, the legitimate concern, there's not enough money in our community. You can at the same time care about your fellow human beings and have concern that my kids going to an underfunded school.
It's not all people have it being totally heartless.
No.
And also, Stephen Lynch is in the Boston Herald this morning.
Congressman
Lynch just went down there on a fact-finding mission, and he's citing this House Judiciary report that says, in fact, two-thirds of these kids historically that have been coming in the last 6 months get their request for asylum immediately granted and then leave and stay here. So he's saying, this is not, you know, the promise.
But a significant percentage of the 60,000
end up staying here because they have a mother here or they have an aunt here
or
they have a father
for
here.
Deval Patrick.
And then that's the issue. Then where do they go? They're going to Brockton. They're going to Lawrence.
Right.
They're going to Lowell. Well, not so much Lowell.
Well, I just think that all this hand-wringing, though, I mean, we don't do this unless there's an emergency. Hey, there's no money for the schools. There's no money to handle these things. No kidding. You know, this is not breaking news. And suddenly we have these kids and we're blaming them for this problem. But then you look at a school district like Revere, who became one of the leading urban school districts in America recently. I lived in Revere before there were a lot of Cambodian and Vietnamese folks. My mother worked with the folks to help settle them. And a lot of really smart people in Revere decided to get federal funding and make magnet schools. And it has one of the best school systems of an urban area because they were able to react and build around that.
Well, it's going to get even better because I'm sure you've heard that if they do a pre-K program, it's going to be housed at the casino. So
yes.
It actually would be a very good...
I'm all for it.
Yeah, I got that. We're talking to Sue O'Connell, co-publisher of Bay Windows in the South End News.
You have another great piece. I love this one, talking about the radical conservative extremists.
Yes.
Now, give us the thesis.
Well,
we only have
game.
A little bit of a minute or so left.
It's all about the name game, and I think liberals lose this all the time. And instead of calling them, you know, the conservatives, they're radical. The people who are leading the news charge are these radical conservative extremists. And I think we need to look at the Hobby Lobby ruling, instead of calling it an exemption, call it a privilege. It's a religious privilege. They said that gay rights were special rights. I say that if you want a religious exemption, it's a religious privilege. And that's what my friend Amy Hunt, who you may know, who was very, very busy in the marriage wars back in the beginning of this century, has coined it. And it's time that we start taking the gloves off. It's a religious privilege. It's not religious exemption.
Oh, yeah. But let's end with the discussion that I mentioned you and I have had for probably 15 years or whatever. You never saw the speed of this coming
Never.
Never.
No.
Your view was that someday the Supreme Court in 10 years or whatever is going to say the United States Constitution prohibits discrimination based upon your sexual orientation.
Right.
But never, state by state. It's unbelievable.
No, and it is. And it's understandable, the sort of reaction. I feel a little guilty, like we took our eye off this Hobby Lobby business, like, and we're all going to get, you know, we're all going to get it because of it. But it's a melting pot. We'll all figure it out because we're American.
Well, we didn't get to discuss your section about what the masters are doing to the servants in this radical conservative extremist thing. We're out of time.
Well, I'll get to that again.
But next time you come, we'll get into that because
the masters and the servants.
The masters and the servants. That's right. Sue O'Connell, thank you very much for being here. Sue O'Connell is a co-publisher of Bay Windows and the South End News. This is Boston Public Radio. Tune into 89.7 WGBH for our next hour of radio. We're going to talk to two loyal employees who've been fired from Market Basket.
They are unbelievable, by the way. 68 years of service at Market Basket between them.
Yeah, we're going to talk to them. We're going to talk to the Boston Police Commissioner, Bill Evans. We'll also ask you if you want a robot to take care of you in your old age. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.